burns down by itself. Every fire needs a little bit of help. Nothing ever burns down by itself. Every fire needs a little bit of help.
You're listening to From Embers, a podcast of anarchist ideas and practice across so-called Canada. Today we're sharing an interview with two settler anarchists in northern British Columbia who are active in a growing struggle against the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Project, or PRGT, pipeline. Resistance to this project has been heating up all summer as government approvals have been rolling in and construction work is expected to begin in the fall of 2025. Our guests provided a really good history and overview of the project, so I'm going to let them tell you about it themselves. But I do want to note that this interview was conducted in stages over the summer, and the situation on the ground continues to evolve. For the most up-to-date information on the project, check out prgt-news.ghost.io. And for some ongoing reports and communiques related to this interview, you can check out bccounterinfo.org, which I would recommend visiting using Tor browser. And one last note, for security reasons, this interview was revoiced by voice actors, and thank you to both of you for doing that for us. If you want to hear more content like this, check out our back catalog of more than 100 episodes at fromembers.libsyn.com or search for From Embers in your favorite podcast platform. All right, welcome to the show. How would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hey, thanks for having us. We're two settler anarchists from the northern BC area and have spent time involved in resistance to resource extraction projects in various ways over the years. You can call me Dee.
And I'm Kay.
Okay, let's just start with some background. What is the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Project, which we're going to call the PRGT, and who is behind it? Where is it supposed to be going, and which Indigenous territories is it going to cross? And can you just give us a brief history of the whole project?
PRGT is a proposed 800-kilometer pipeline that would carry liquefied natural gas, or LNG, from fracking fields in northeastern BC to a proposed export facility on the coast just north of Prince Rupert, BC, near a small Nisga village named Kincolith. It crosses many Indigenous territories, some of which are the Gitxsan, Gitanyau, and Nisga. The project was originally approved by the province in 2014, and at that time was owned by TC Energy, the same company responsible for the Coastal GasLink pipeline. The province and TC Energy managed to get multiple elected band councils, as well as hereditary chiefs, to sign an impact benefits agreement for the pipeline. This agreement offered them an amount of money in exchange for their support for the pipeline, and came with numerous conditions, one of which required them to actively suppress any resistance brought about by their own people. I am sure a lot of listeners know this already, but if not, it is helpful to understand the difference between the band council system of government in contrast to the hereditary system of governance. The Canadian government, as well as many Canadians, use these terms interchangeably, and this is inaccurate as well as problematic. We could dive much deeper into this, but I'll keep it short. The hereditary chiefs, or hereditary governance system, represents a pre-colonial, traditional way of organization and governance. In the case of the Gitxsan, which lately has been a focal point of PRGT resistance, their nation's territory is divided up into WILPs, which translates in English as house groups. Each house group has one or more territories, and there is one or more chiefs from that WILP who are responsible to their territory and WILP members. In contrast, the band council system is a colonial system installed by the Canadian government through the Indian Act in an attempt to wipe out traditional governance structures. These band councils only have jurisdiction over their reserves. Within the traditional governance system of the Gitxsan, there is no official governing body that represents the entire Gitxsan nation as a whole. Each house group is completely autonomous and has full decision-making ability over their own territory. This dynamic doesn't work well for Canada because they would have to consult and negotiate with way too many people to get approval from each territory that it crosses. Canada wants one representative for each nation that they can pressure into acceptance, so they often look to the band councils for this. However, the communities can be divided as well, and there can be disputes over chief names and who actually has a say over specific territory. In a couple examples where there are two people claiming to have the position of chief for a given territory, one will be pro and the other will be anti-pipeline. So obviously the pipeline company and Canada will recognize and communicate with and work with the one who is pro-pipeline. For PRGT, this came in the form of an impact benefits agreement back in 2014, where numerous hereditary chiefs signed on to the pipeline and were given a varying amount of money. Some signed because they wanted the pipeline, and some just thought it was going to happen anyway, so may as well get a bit of money out of it. As well, there were chiefs with territories that the pipeline doesn't even cross who also signed the impact benefits agreement. This is a PR stunt that plays on the ignorance of the average Canadian's understanding of how the traditional system works. So then the company can boast about how many Gixan chiefs they got to sign. As far as the history of this pipeline, back in 2014, they initially had some work crews on the ground, mostly surveyors. They were met with some local resistance, and it's a little unclear how much they actually accomplished. The focal point at that time became the export facility that PRGT was supposed to supply. This was proposed to be constructed on Lulu Island, on Tsimshian territory near Prince Rupert. This facility was strongly opposed by locals and faced a fierce resistance. A major reoccupation camp was started on the island, and company surveyors and workers were physically stopped by defenders at the camp from completing any of their work. The company never ended up getting an injunction, so police intervention was very minimal. Eventually, the company backed out of building the export facility, and since PRGT now has no destination, it was kind of in limbo and went on hiatus. Fast forward to early 2024, TC Energy sells the project to the Nisga Nation and Western LNG, who is a company from Texas. The Ksi-Lisim export facility is proposed by the Nisga Nation, and PRGT starts picking up steam again. In the summer of 2024, PRGT carried out some low-level construction work, mostly fixing up roads and clearing the easily accessible parts of the right-of-way. This took place only on Nisga territory. It was done because, in the fall of 2024, PRGT's environmental certificate was about to expire, and if they were able to show that they had substantially started the project, then the certificate would be good indefinitely. If not, then it would expire, and they would have to go through a new environmental assessment again. The common understanding locally is that they barely accomplished any work, let alone the project being substantially started, yet locals all expected it to be determined substantially started and for them to get their certificate locked in. And then, early June 2025, it is announced that PRGT can proceed with construction using its 10-year-old environmental certificate. The latest we have heard is that some construction is expected to begin in the fall of 2025. Recently, however, there have been reports of PRGT doing some small-scale initial fieldwork in a couple communities. PRGT could be in a fairly vulnerable stage right now, as they don't have a final investment decision nor an injunction. Resistance at this stage of a project is often easier and more impactful, as police forces have not yet developed a presence and investors are still not fully committed.
I'm just curious if you see the NDP government in British Columbia specifically having a particular formula for how they develop pipelines, as opposed to more centrist and right-wing governments across Canada.
Across North America in recent years, the construction of major oil and gas infrastructure required the deployment of massive police efforts to shut down opposition. For example, Standing Rock, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, Line 3, Line 9, and CGL. I think civil society more broadly only recognizes the legitimacy of this resistance based on it being led by Indigenous peoples. In response, we can see the state and industry scramble to move towards Indigenous ownership, going as far to sell the pipeline to the Nisga Nation, in reality simply giving it to them with agreement they would pay for it upon completion. In this sense, it is a counterinsurgency strategy that seeks to preemptively marginalize resistance to projects. For many citizens who find themselves trapped in the process of politics, looking to leaders elected or otherwise to represent diverse groups, this might be enough to deem the project as socially legitimate. There's no difference from age-old tactics of dividing resistors, such as labeling groups as extremists, outside agitators, and others as community members and legitimate protesters. It very well may allow NDP voters to back the project, but I think it's more insidious than that. Partial Indigenous ownership of industrial projects has also been used to establish agreements between Indigenous politicians and the state to shut down internal Indigenous resistance to projects. In regards to PRGT, we've seen this at least on Gitxsan and Nisga territory. Further south, we also have seen this dynamic at play around the Fairy Creek logging struggles, where, as part of receiving benefit agreements with forestry companies, Pachidat leadership agreed to quell resistance among Pachidat people. This era may also be shifting underneath our feet with the trade war and Canada's goals of becoming an energy superpower, whatever the consequences, but we are still at an in-between stage. There's lots of new regulation in BC, specifically around renewable energy projects, that are basically, if it's 50% native-owned and it's a certain size and it's renewable, it's instantly approved. So it seems like the state is trying to emphasize Indigenous ownership of these projects.
Yeah, I think that flows into my next question, which is sort of about the narratives that governments are using to justify these projects. I think the newest one that I've been seeing emerging lately is this narrative around the trade war between Canada and the US since Trump was elected, and a lot more talk about nation building, infrastructure, energy independence, Canadian sovereignty, all of these things. And these concepts are being deployed sort of across the mainstream political spectrum in response to Trump's rhetoric around annexation and the impact that tariffs are having and expected to have. Are there any sort of ways that you see the context of the PRGT pipeline development shifting given this emerging narrative? I also want to mention Bill 15, which is a federal bill which will quickly grant federal approvals on large industrial projects. And here in Ontario, that's coupling with another law that creates special economic zones that will bypass regulations, such as environmental assessments. I really know the provincial government here is eager to use these sort of states of exception to develop the Ring of Fire up in Northern Ontario, for example. I'm just wondering if that's the kind of thing that you're expecting might be invoked in BC or federally with respect to the PRGT.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. The context is changing. There's always been a current, specifically from Alberta more strongly, but also from a part of BC politics that said we need energy independence. And then the recent changes with Trump being elected and the tariffs and all those threats have added a lot of fuel to this reality. To me, I think it's just the justification that was on hand in this given moment, and they were always committed to go through with development regardless of the justification. But I think in a bigger picture, what you're pointing out is that there's this larger nationalist surge and maybe even restructuring and fast-tracking of projects and restructuring of the economy or the energy grid specifically. I think energy is worth our focus in this context because it's the backbone of everything. Globally, energy production is being restructured to be more resilient and productive to meet higher and higher demands. Energy is inseparable from technological advancements like advanced military weapons and AI. This world needs more and more energy, and all these technological advancements are inseparable from social control. There's been quite a bit of other big industrial approvals, mainly around renewable energy. Basically a push towards more and more domestic capacity for energy production and export outside of the United States. I think this also fits into a bigger global reality of war, which is also intertwined with energy and all these technologies. And just like nationalism, that's become more front and center. And just a heightened tension of possible conflicts or proxy conflicts. And I think what this is going to mean specifically for repression of struggles around it all is it's going to be much harsher than we've seen in the past, because there's a certain way that the state could say, hey, you know, at a certain point, it was okay for you guys to fight, and now things are bad, the economy is bad, it's time to tighten up our belts, and we're all going to have to make sacrifices. Mark Carney literally said that in his throne speech, we're all going to have to make sacrifices. But obviously, he's not making any. He basically said, we're going to become an energy superpower. We're committing to NATO, and we've all got to tighten up our belts to make this happen. So I think projects like PRGT or massive industrial energy projects are central to becoming an energy superpower and the economy of Canada. We have an economy based on extraction, and these kinds of projects are going to become more and more central. It'll be important for anarchists and radicals to make sure that we're critiquing these projects. It's not a single issue critique, and we're not against the pipeline because it's Alberta's pipeline, and we're not against it because it's Trump's pipeline, because that's been argued too. Regardless of who owns it or what it is, we should have a critique of capitalism, the state, and how these things come together in industrial development.
Can you briefly explain the Delgamuukw case and how it shapes Indigenous sovereignty struggles across BC?
So the Delgamuukw case was a case that the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en in northern BC launched against the Crown in the late 90s and ended up going to the Supreme Court. It was the first case that examined Aboriginal title. As a rough summary, the court recognized this is in fact Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en land and that land is central to Indigenous culture. But it didn't say what the land being Indigenous meant in a tangible way, and went as far as explicitly laying out a very generous framework for infringing on Aboriginal rights and title, which basically said any economic or industrial development has good reason to infringe and disregard Aboriginal title. The court recognized the legitimacy of oral testimony in the courts, which is seen as a success for Indigenous peoples interested in the courts to see their history as legitimate. The court said essentially that this is native land as long as industrial development isn't interested in it. The way some people talk about this legal case, you can trace its beginning to a large sovereignty movement which looked like anti-logging struggles that had been happening on Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en territories in the 80s and 90s that were fierce. People were on the land blocking roads, blocking mills, blocking the rails, and so it was part of a larger struggle for sovereignty that a lot of people were involved in, and many of those folks are still around today and will be at meetings and give speeches and have had a big impact. Because of that, this case specifically in this region looms in people's minds. There's anniversary celebrations and everything. So despite the government deciding that this was in fact Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en land, nothing has really changed. And so some people from that have developed a critique of the courts and a critique of looking to them for legitimacy or for permission. And then other people see this case as an affirmation that they won this big, significant victory and that they just need to go a little bit further in the courts to get something and to be recognized as legitimate. So it's kind of a double-edged sword in the sense that for some, a less popular position is that it exposes the fact that the courts are always going to be hostile to Indigenous sovereignty. And for others, it kind of puts them in perfect dialogue with the courts that says the courts have engaged with this question in the past, they've even ruled in our favor. That's a pretty popular opinion, and it definitely shaped struggles in the region. And even in the Wet'suwet'en struggle, we saw the way that many chiefs wanted to turn to the courts. Or with the Memorandum of Understanding, where in the height of Shutdown Canada, or maybe on the tail end, the province sat down with several Wet'suwet'en chiefs and promised them a seat at the table, and to revisit the question of Wet'suwet'en land ownership via the courts. Obviously, as an anarchist, I don't think that question will ever be answered by the courts, and I think many native sovereigntists also think that, but it's still a popular position.
So many of our listeners will be familiar with the fight against the Coastal GasLink pipeline on Wet'suwet'en territory over the years, and in particular the sort of peak of activity in early 2020 during the Shutdown Canada moment. Can you compare and contrast the two situations and struggles? And do you think that this struggle has the potential to generalize and become another Shutdown Canada type moment?
Yeah, there are some similarities, but it's a very different situation for sure. With CGL, the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs were united in their opposition to the pipeline's construction, while a lot of the bands were supportive of it. In contrast, a lot of Gitxsan hereditary chiefs have signed on in support of the pipeline, and some bands have come out against it. An interesting outcome of this situation is hearing some Gitxsan express that their chiefs have sold them out, and it's their responsibility to protect their territory, with or without the chiefs. Obviously, it would be better if everyone was against it together, but it poses some interesting dynamics where people are acting on their own. This has the potential to avoid some of the problems that arose in the past with centralized decision making. This, in turn, can put pressure on the chiefs to listen and to support the actions of a younger generation. With CGL in Wet'suwet'en territory, where the majority of resistance was, a lot of the construction took place in very remote areas, or areas that were far enough from population centers that it was inaccessible for a lot of people to participate. This resulted in a lot of the resistance, construction, traffic, and police oppression going unnoticed by locals. With PRGT, though, the proposed route takes it right through a couple populated areas. This will result in very heavy construction traffic traveling through areas that were not designed for high traffic flows. There will be major construction as well as man camps close to residences, putting it in full view of the public. If blockades occur, they could likely be close by, if not right in the towns, which makes it way more accessible for the average person. Participation as well as fast response times when numbers are needed. If police crack down or are just demonstrating their force, this too would be in the public eye. If pipeline traffic has to go through Hazleton and its communities, which is likely, then from the highway, it will have to pass through at least four different communities. A couple reserve communities and a couple settler communities, both of which have demonstrated opposition to PRGT in the past. Another very interesting situation that could occur is that if blockades happen in one of these smaller periphery communities, then there could be one or more communities with hundreds of residences entirely behind the blockade, with the only access being through the blockade. This has some tactical advantages when cops are on one side and the majority of the community is on the other. Travel to and from the blockades could happen without police ground surveillance or interaction. If police enforcement happens, it would have to travel through multiple communities to reach the potential blockade. Shutdown Canada was an inspiring moment for a lot of us. It felt like, finally, this might get somewhere. It might bring us into new terrain with widespread rebellion. I remember every couple days hearing about another blockade being set up. There were cops patrolling and just sitting near railroad crossings that they thought were likely blockade spots. It really showed the vulnerability of their security system. There isn't enough of them to prevent something that widespread. There's too many vulnerable places within their infrastructure. I think it was a big wake-up call for the Canadian authorities to take it more seriously. My worry is that they took it more seriously than the rest of us. They sat down and studied all the actions, the responses, and developed their own countermeasures to deal with the next mass resistance. I hope that those involved in the Shutdown Canada actions did something similar. Analyzed what worked, learned from their mistakes, thought critically about what they could have done differently or better, and passed those lessons on to others stepping up to resist in future struggles. Shutdown Canada was pretty taxing on a lot of communities, but I would hope that it set a precedent of what solidarity can look like. It definitely isn't always going to go that way, though. For example, the year after Shutdown Canada, the Wet'suwet'en had another blockade at Coyote Camp, which some might say was more fierce and had widespread support. But when the raids happened there, we didn't see anything to the level of solidarity like we did in 2020. I think it was the right combination of cards all lined up. The Wet'suwet'en invested years of prep work leading up to the blockades. They toured all over the place making connections and building a support base. People from other communities were invited and welcomed into the struggle, which created strong relationship to their home communities. People can get easily desensitized to oppression when it happens regularly. We will have to see how this all plays out, who gets involved, and who wants to throw down elsewhere. Something I'm always thinking about is how solidarity often occurs in response to repression. The Shutdown Canada blockades largely popped off after the police raided the Wet'suwet'en camps. This put a ton of pressure on the Canadian state and the economy, but they had already broken the Wet'suwet'en blockades, allowing CGL to begin construction again. Then, with the emergency taken care of in northern BC, authorities were able to focus on defeating resistance elsewhere. I like to imagine how potent solidarity could be if it didn't wait for repression, but if it happened in response to resistance. When one community throws down, another recognizes the importance and urgency of the situation and steps up to have their back. This could spread to become something truly uncontrollable and have some remarkable opportunities. There aren't enough cops to deal with numerous major resistance situations at the same time. For example, Fairy Creek was happening at the same time as Coyote Camp in Wet'suwet'en territory, and the cops weren't able to deal with both. They would have a major presence in one place or the other, but not at the same time. And when the big raid happened at Coyote Camp, they had to ship in RCMP ERT members from across the province and country. This would create opportunity for other communities to take advantage of the lack of ability for the ERT to respond. We don't need to wait for the next big thing. We just need to be ready.
So, yeah, my friend Kay touched on a lot of good points. One thing that Kay mentioned is the geography of this is very different in the way that it passes through a lot of towns. A lot of these regions are one-road communities where everything has to travel because of the mountainous terrain. There's not very many ways to travel, and to think about how much traffic we saw on the Wet'suwet'en Yintah, going through town is going to be insane and dramatically impact daily life for everybody. Whereas the construction of the CGL pipeline was isolated, hours away from where most people live. And you could almost pretend not to see it. Not totally because there's still impacts, all the workers and the gentrification and all these other things, but I think this is going to be a much more visceral experience, and it's going to make struggling against the project more accessible. We've seen blockades pop up on the railway tracks on Gitxsan territory. There's a precedent to that historically, and over the last few years, in solidarity mainly with events on the Wet'suwet'en Yintah. There's been blockades put up and they're in town. So people come by after work, or people pop in whenever, or in the context of repression, when the police arrive to dismantle blockades, people show up, even if there's only 3 or 4 people there at first. And that's a very different reality than a remote bush camp. So I think this struggle has an opportunity to be a lot more explosive socially. The terrain of struggle, where this project is being confronted as a front line, is already much larger. There's already been action against the pipeline in a huge area compared to CGL. Historically, that's something also true in the way that Mati Li was initially set up, and then an occupation on Leilu Island was set up, and those are hundreds of kilometers apart, against the original PRGT pipeline in 2014. As Kay mentioned, there kind of needs to be some magic for those really explosive moments of revolt to spread across the country. I do think that this has an opportunity, and I don't want to be mechanistic, and that's where the magical element comes into this. But the ingredients are there: tension around colonization, extractivism, a love for the land, capital interest bent on destroying the land. People here love this land and want to fight for it and have a fighting spirit. Even in my experience of just walking around town and talking to random people, people bring up the project with me and wanting to struggle against it. I think it's very much on people's minds, and resistance here will be fierce. The tension around colonialism, the violence of the colonial project, and the exclusion of indigenous people, I think that has the potential to explode. We saw how indigenous people across Canada saw themselves in the Wet'suwet'en fight, and solidarity can flow from seeing each other and one another struggle. More broadly, lots of people who saw themselves as excluded or as pushed to the margins also saw themselves in the Wet'suwet'en struggle. It really inspired a sense of solidarity. These unresolvable points of social tension in our region also exist nationally. As anarchists, we should ask ourselves, what can we do and what kind of practices can we put forward that can bring these tensions to a head?
So I want to go back to something that Kay said earlier about hoping that people had learned some lessons from Shutdown Canada in 2020 that they can apply here. Just one thing I've been thinking about is here in Eastern Ontario where I live, COVID hit in March 2020. And our organizing around that, we did try to continue, but after a few weeks, it became clear that that was going to be nearly impossible to do so with the same momentum that we had, and we kind of called it. And I do regret that we never really had a chance to properly debrief Shutdown Canada and lay out some lessons that we can carry forward in our community. I mean, people don't all agree with me on this, but I also think that the cycle of repression that was starting to ramp up in Hamilton, Toronto, Montreal, We even noticed a change in how things were being policed in Kingston. That also was interrupted because of the COVID crisis. And I'm still grappling with what that means exactly. But I think, you know, even though it's good maybe that that repression cycle was, you know, somewhat limited by the COVID interruption, we did miss learning some lessons and being able to share those with others, I think, through that process.
You're right that COVID just led to general alienation and individualization. We all took space from each other. The word conspire means to breathe together, and if we're not together and talking and reflecting, we're not going to take those lessons in the same way. When you say repression was different, what do you mean?
I guess I'm most familiar with, you know, Hamilton, Toronto, Kingston, Montreal, and this time. I just think there was a certain amount for a while that we could get away with if we had a big enough group because of this sort of popular support and the general context at the time, mostly talking about nonviolent direct actions where a bridge was getting blocked or a railway was getting blocked. And that was working really well for a while. But I did notice that after Justin Trudeau's The Blockades Must Come Down speech that he gave on TV, after the Tyndinaga blockade was attacked by the Ontario Provincial Police, the policing posture and strategy generally shifted after that. And we started seeing more arrests happening in Toronto and Hamilton. And I did sort of, I think we all had the feeling, the people I was in touch with, that, you know, we're going to keep going, but the political winds had definitely shifted. And if people wanted to maintain our blockades, we're going to have to use a different strategy going forward, maybe be more willing to defend them. I'm not sure, you know, how prepared we were to do that with the kind of organizing that we were doing. So there was this kind of big question mark there that was raised, but never really got properly answered because of that COVID interruption.
I'm sure that's a reflection many share. This could always be a question we're asking ourselves, like, how is our context changing and what does that mean? Obviously, COVID blindsided a lot of us because none of us had lived through an experience like that. But in larger ways, we can take some lessons that you're sharing and ask, how is our context going to change? Some of your previous questions alluded to how context might change in the context of nationalism or war or something else. And as I said, repression and the struggles to come will be very different and much harsher. In this region, at least, at the end of the day, there haven't been a lot of charges considering everything that's happened and how fierce resistance has been. Repression is designed to be suffocating, and knowing this will always be the case, and will likely only increasingly be so. I feel inspired by comrades who try not to center repression by creating stories that place the power of repressive bodies at the center of the narrative, but rather place those who fight at the center of the narrative. It feels more empowering and somehow makes it all feel a little less scary. If we play too much into their narrative, we end up doing the ultimate work of repression by repressing ourselves. Something else that feels possible to reflect on when we look at how repression cracks down on bottlenecked and sometimes predictable defensive organizing, like blockades, is that this might be different if we expand our terrain of struggle, appearing where they aren't expecting us, becoming unpredictable, and potentially even uncontrollable. They study us, they study how movements function, and so we have to be creative.
I'm curious what your take is on the shutdown Canada idea in general. So the first time I came across it was in, I think, 2013, around the Elsie Pucktuck anti-fracking struggle in New Brunswick. And it was very much this idea that if the RCMP attack our camp, then everybody responds and shuts everything down. So it was meant very explicitly as a threat to deter police action against Indigenous reclamation camps.
I heard about it first in 2020, but I've since then heard this longer history. I think it's interesting the connection you're making between it fundamentally having a defensive posture, which I think it did in 2020 as well. Solidarity actions started after repression. Like, people weren't orienting their lives towards struggling until the repression happened. Waiting for repression, or waiting in general, is a fundamentally defensive position, a reactive position, which I think is very limiting.
In 2020, I think partly because of the Wet'suwet'en PR strategy, there was just a really big buildup. You know, a narrative was created, everybody was waiting for the raid to move into action. part of that is knowing that there's this very human thing where people are going to feel, you know, emotional when they see those images and those videos of the police violence. I think intellectually, you know, a lot of people would agree that it's better to be proactive and not always on the defensive. But if we want that large movement, that big reaction that includes liberals and regular people feeling suddenly moved to action, I think it does take at least something emotional like that to, as part of that recipe, you know?
You're right in that people aren't going to be moved to resist often. And it takes these emotional questions of the heart to get us onto our feet and to get us thinking and engaging. But as anarchists, we can move away from reactivity and struggle in moments of relative societal calm, to experiment with anarchist ways of intervening in reality. And then there'll be these larger moments, these larger eruptions and tensions, where other people are going to be moved to action, and these moments of revolt that go beyond the individual. But the reality is that oftentimes, as anarchists, we're going to be an active minority. An active minority can contribute to the imaginary of what's possible and inspire others to go beyond when that calm is broken.
I am reminded of just the number of people in Kingston who were willing to stand on the train tracks or international bridges in 2020, seemingly all of a sudden, to me it felt unthinkable, you know, 2 months earlier. And the fact that so many people would just get on a school bus, go to the border and stand on a bridge, like, that was crazy to me. And people were just saying, yeah, we're doing this. We saw other people doing it. We think it's necessary. And that just happened.
That totally makes sense. It's always significant when anarchists find themselves in those moments. It can be really humbling. Sometimes I forget the desire that other people have to fight. For example, I heard that at Ferry Creek, tons of people were digging up the road with pickaxes and shovels. In the context of anti-logging struggles on Vancouver Island that have such a non-violent kind of history, digging up the road would not have been such a widespread or celebrated thing. But in that moment, a practice that previously would have been only carried out by a minority of people became very popular. So it sounded like there were just hundreds of people without masks being filmed by cops just digging up the road.
So just getting back to the PRGT now, what are some recent or existing blockades and checkpoints that have been set up to oppose that pipeline or other pipelines in the area?
Well, we may as well start with the first and longest standing blockade, which is Mattie Lee. Mattie Lee is the name of the territory which belongs to the House of Lukudziwus that PRGT is proposed to run through. Of all the Gixan territories that are crossed by PRGT, Mattie Lee has the longest stretch and is arguably most affected. The blockade was originally started in 2014 in response to PRGT surveyor activity. A gate was set up blocking the only road access to the whole territory. A camp was built at this site with numerous cabins, a big house, a smokehouse, and it is still active and expanding as we speak. Mattie Lee could be described as a successful example of a liberated space from Canada. This will likely get put to the test as this pipeline progresses, but for over 10 years now, there has been no industry or resource extraction taking place behind the line, and in one internal report, the BC government had declared Mattie Lee an economic dead zone, recommending investors look elsewhere. Locally, it is considered to be a major success for Gixan liberation and resistance to resource extraction. This isn't the only point of resistance, though. A Gitanyah host group set up a checkpoint on their territory at the Cranberry Junction at Highway 37 that, at the time, was blocking PRGT pipeline traffic heading into Nisga territory in the Nass River Valley. This was in the summer and fall of 2024. As of now, this checkpoint has been taken down voluntarily, but is likely to get set back up. Another spot is on the territory of the Gitludal House Group. This territory includes the point of the river where the pipeline is proposed to cross. At the moment, it is not a blockade, but pipeline work has not commenced in this area. A camp has been set up with multiple dwellings, and a rescue dog sanctuary has been established here. So, these are three examples of local resistance that has been established already, and work has not yet even started in the area. There are also reports of multiple other blockades or checkpoints being discussed as well.
What are some roles that anarchists are proposing to take in the fight against the PRGT? What lessons are being taken from the fight against the Coastal GasLink pipeline that people are trying to apply now?
So first off, I'd say that there are many anarchists in the region who see things differently. So I'm speaking just for myself here. A few comrades have been proposing the development of an autonomous anarchist struggle against this pipeline and its world. When I say autonomous, I mean a struggle that exists outside of the ebbs and flows of social movements, that has its own analysis, its own reason to fight something, that sets its own pace of deciding when and where to engage. This struggle could be in dialogue and will be in solidarity with social movements or other fighters in the region, the indigenous-led blockades, and other actions that I think are going to continue to happen, but seeks to be based on analysis and have a longer-term vision than simply being a participant in those struggles. As part of this autonomous initiative, comrades have also articulated struggling using the style of self-organization, refusing to engage with the state and direct action. Self-organization, as in organizing ourselves in the informal formations that we see fit, not looking to any outside body, such as NGOs, to tell us what to do, but instead decide for ourselves how, when, and where to resist. Refusing to engage means rejecting the mediation of the state and its representatives, not asking for anything from the courts or recognizing those in power, which is a relationship we fundamentally want to live without. Direct action means taking it into our own hands to stop the project, not having a pressure campaign, but trying to concretely stop its function. I think this style is necessary if we want to live in a world without the state and the social relations wrapped up in it. The idea is not just for anarchists and is not aimed at creating more anarchists. It's concerned with organizing against this pipeline, not forming a specific group or identity. Though I think that anarchists may be a minority of people who take up this style of organizing, it creates a different frame of reference for trying to imagine what the struggle could look like. I think we should actively try to experiment and put forward examples and ideas for others in revolt. These organizing styles are already part of many of our lives and those of others in the region. For example, we've already seen unclaimed direct action against the project, which directly tries to stop it, without communicating with those in power. For example, there are whispers of anonymous sabotage of machinery in the Nass Valley on Nisga territory last summer. These methods are also necessary in a broader sense to truly break with the ways we are taught to be passive citizens and look to representatives to give us what we need. Taking responsibility for ourselves in these kinds of ways that we are not taught is a necessary step for a radical break with this reality, whether that be insurrection or one-day revolution. I think revolt begins with taking responsibility for our lives in big and small ways, making decisions for ourselves with those we trust. This pipeline is a good site to put forward such an experiment because of the palpable anger around it and the larger processes it is a part of, such as colonization, extraction, and poverty. In fighting, I've experienced, and I think it's possible for others to experience, a profound connection to place, a sense of dignity and social relations which break with the daily drudgery of work, alienation, and a life spent in front of a screen. In this sense, I think that the struggle can open up opportunities to experience something different and outside of the daily violence of capitalism and colonization. Also, this pipeline is a good place to put our efforts because energy and extractivism more broadly is the backbone of the Canadian state. Confronting that is a necessary precursor to opportunities for freedom. I think we're seeing energy restructure itself to be more resilient and more inseparable from war, militarization, the destruction of the world, and social control via AI, data centers, etc. Sometimes it feels to me like this world of technology, fueled by an ever-increasing demand for energy, is hurling towards an abyss with possibilities for subversion shrinking. Because of this bleak state of affairs, I think anarchist experiments against technology and its inseparable ingredient, energy, are worthwhile to pursue. Some of the lessons I took in the struggle against CGL was the importance of expanding the terrain of struggle both physically and socially. The experience of fighting in remote occupations in the bush made it clear how isolated those resisting could be, and that beyond a relatively small group of participants, the will to fight against the project didn't spread. I saw many come to the Yuntah and then return to relatively normal lives at home, separating their fighting spirit from their daily lives, leaving the responsibility to initiate confrontations with the horrors of this world onto leaders. Physically, I think it's important to expand the terrain of struggles, because by expanding where and when we fight, we become more uncontrollable. I saw this happen during Shutdown Canada, which continues to fuel the imagination of what's possible when the magic of revolt finds itself in a powder keg and catches the right spark. Thinking about what to focus on is important, because as anarchists, many of us hop from single-issue campaign to campaign, and fail to develop a long-term set of skills, analysis, and capacity to take on anything that takes more than a few months, let alone years. I've seen how many skills had not been previously developed, and that when things were popping off, both in the region or across the country, as anarchists we were often caught with our pants down, unable to take advantage of opportunities that presented themselves, such as divided police resources, natural disasters which shut down infrastructure, moments of large growth of participants in the struggle. All these reflections highlight the importance of developing an autonomous struggle that equips us with skills and experiences today that can help us contribute to moments of widespread social revolt in the future.
Kays, is there anything you want to add to that?
Sharing lessons and experiences from previous struggles is critical to advancing collective knowledge in a community culture of resistance. Here's a couple thoughts in no particular order. 1. Is the blockade a means or an end? Presently, there is some talk among community members about blockades, as this seems like an accessible course of action for community members to start with. Sometimes, though, it sounds like the objective is the blockade, like, now we've played our big card and now we wait for the police to respond, kind of thing. However, with a quick glance at the history of blockades in this province, or examining the experiences of people fighting CGL and other projects, one can take away some key points. Blockades have varying degrees of success and impact depending on their context, but if they are not voluntarily taken down, then they are often dealt with by a large-scale police enforcement of an injunction. So, knowing this, we can start here and work backward. Some questions to ask could be, what is the actual objective of the blockade? To take, hold, and defend space? This can be good in itself, but it can also create opportunities for autonomous action protected by the blockade. We don't want to merely wait for the police to come get us. Let's think of ways to maximize the opportunities created by a defended space, no matter how temporary. This is an important thing to address with participants during the preliminary discussions prior to establishing the block. Equally important to discuss is, how are you going to respond to a large-scale police enforcement? We know that that's where it's going to lead if we are successful, so let's at least think that through. Let's get creative and develop new ways of dealing with or injunctions and responding to large-scale police enforcement, because so far those seem to be the enemy's silver bullet. 2. Don't give them an inch. Each advancing step the project takes forward, no matter how small, makes it that much harder to stop. Once they gain momentum, investment, infrastructure, and security presence increase at a pace that is very hard to keep up with. They are way more organized than we usually are, as their project, as well as how to deal with resistance, is planned out years in advance. Once they have that much invested, they are much less willing to back down. It seems people often ignore the seemingly meaningless small work that the company does in the initial stages and wait for the larger, more obvious stages of construction to initiate resistance. However, these initial small steps are often critical to begin the bigger steps. They also rarely have a security presence established and likely don't have an injunction yet. These initial stages are the most likely chance you will have to show them that it's going to be a big fight that's not worth their risk. So, don't let them get anything done. With all that said, if the project does advance, you can count on its complexity to create opportunities for action and resistance against a variety of vulnerabilities. These projects are often covering a huge area and distance that is difficult for them to secure. 3. Be prepared for success. We often sell ourselves short and assume we will fail or be mildly successful at best, and therefore don't think through some critical next steps. Opportunities are often missed because of this assumption. we could ask ourselves, what happens if we're successful? What opportunities would arise? How can we take advantage of them? Can we adapt to the evolving situation? And are we prepared to deal with what presents itself? If we are willing to put the time, energy, and risk into action for the purpose of winning, the least we can do is be prepared to take advantage of any opportunity that presents itself as a result. 4. Bring something to the table. Don't wait for an active situation to determine what you need to learn or practice. The more we develop skills and knowledge, gain experience and training, the better we are equipped to contribute to resistance in any form. If we show up to the party without much to add, then we are likely going to follow suit with what's already being proposed or happening. This isn't a bad thing, and we've all been there, but if we are trained, knowledgeable, and well-practiced, then we will be more likely to spot and take advantage of opportunities that could otherwise be missed. Confidence and capacity in yourself and your team are amplified when everyone is nerding out on their own thing. This comes together in a way where your crew is ready for anything, pushing the limits of action and resistance.
So I'd like to read from an anarchist call to action that was posted online anonymously to BC Counterinfo in November of 2024. Quote, "We propose an offensive struggle of diffuse blows carried out by affinity groups in dispersed formation, as others have said, to act without forming compact columns, without building permanent indefensible encampments. Instead, we seek to extend diffuse hostilities over a large terrain." End quote. So it does sound to me like the author or authors of this piece are explicitly rejecting the strategy of going to indigenous-led camps on the path of the pipeline in favor of taking more offensive actions. Is that fair to say?
It does sound like somewhat of a rejection to that approach, but it might also just be a proposal for another direction. It's probably up for interpretation by the reader. It's important, though, to remember that this statement or call to action is the view of its authors and doesn't necessarily reflect the perspective of all anarchists in the region. People are going to be most effective at what they are most passionate about and capable of carrying out. I would hope that individuals and groups are thinking critically and exploring the options available to them in their context. Without regular reevaluation, it is easy to fall into a pattern of action guided by what we know to be a standard response. It is this standard response that authorities are best at dealing with. We must constantly be rethinking and analyzing different tactics to determine what approach will be the most impactful and effective at accomplishing what is desired. Maybe it's multi-phase actions where one can set the stage for the next, where one can open opportunities for the next. As the companies and units of the RCMP adapt and learn how to deal with resistance, we too must be evolving and developing new strategies with tactical creativity.
I read that call to action as a proposal of another way forward, not necessarily a rejection, but an invitation to expand imaginations. It seems to me that the primary way anarchists in Western Canada imagine land defense struggle is to wait for blockades and then to show up as participants. This means a lot of waiting and limited opportunities for self-organization and experimentation. For me, I think seeing participation in blockades and offensive action as being a dichotomy is not useful. It's worth noting that the call to action encourages us to begin from ourselves, which is at odds with a logic that begins with seeing ourselves as strictly participants in the struggle of others, who should then look to others for leadership, who can extend our solidarity but not develop our own struggles, which is often popular in activist circles. As someone who begins from myself as an anarchist, reflecting on my own goals and dreams and the possibilities for solidarity, I recognize an opportunity in engagement in indigenous-led camps. While I don't think autonomous action and blockades are at odds with each other, I think each of us has limited time. We should think about the dedication required to learn skills, build relations, and develop a capacity for action that doesn't rely on blockades as a necessary base. This reflection may lead some of us to snap out of a rhythm of simply participating in Indigenous-led blockades one after another because they're exciting and accessible. Of course, participating in the next exciting thing, whether it's a blockade or a campus occupation, it's appealing as after a week, a month, or a year, you feel like you really contributed to something bigger than yourself. But for myself, at a certain point, I started seeing the importance of standing firmly on my own two feet and having a longer-term perspective and longer-term goals as something embedded in our own struggles. Funnily enough, such a perspective, experience, and skills will mean that we are in the best position to extend solidarity. Being in the position to actively choose to extend solidarity with our own developed skills and struggles is a powerful thing to be able to share with others. As anarchists, we often find ourselves unrooted, looking for something to participate in with little skills, capacity, or resources. Because of this, I like the call to action and see the necessity of immediately beginning to create something on our own terms, which will undoubtedly engage with larger social movements, but exist beyond them as well. Beyond the call and outside of this context, I think it's worth thinking about this topic of waiting, which I think the call to action indirectly addressed. In this context, the call was published last year when the Gitnyau camp and Dog Sanctuary were the only indigenous-led camps trying to stop construction. Gitnyau camp had been navigated around by PRGT, and the Dog Sanctuary on Gitludel territory has yet to be an obstacle for the pipeline. Given this on-the-ground reality, those trying to immediately stop the project and not wait for another blockade to pop up needed to develop their own capacity and space for offensive actions. I think this will continue to be the case, and because of this, developing a capacity for autonomous action is important. Anarchists elsewhere who are also not content with waiting will likely find themselves in a similar boat.
What are some direct actions that have occurred so far against the PRGT?
There was some direct action against the first attempt to build PRGT. Surveyors were evicted from areas and had their equipment taken. Leilu Island was occupied where surveyor boats were kept from landing on the island, surveyor boats were rammed, etc. On Gitsan territory, the Mati Lee camp was established and a gate was installed, as Kay explained. Outside of blockades, I'll try my best to list what I know has happened, but it's impossible to know every direct action that happened, as it seems some have not been claimed. There is some things I know about based on news, communiques, and BC Counter info. So, last summer, I heard of at least one instance of people physically confronting and evicting surveyors in the Kispiel Valley, as well as rumors of sabotage to machinery in the Nass Valley. A communique claimed the spiking of thousands of trees on the right-of-way, and last fall, BC Counter Info republished a news article about an arson of four vehicles in a building and terrace belonging to a PRGT contractor.
Do you see any limitations inherent to that strategy contained in that widely circulated call to actions? And are there other competing or differing anarchist proposals circulating about what to do?
There are going to be limitations to all strategies, but yes, especially if a strategy is recommending people to avoid a tactic that is very popular, fairly effective, and accessible for the average person to participate in some form. It's open for interpretation, but I would hope this call-out is more intended as a proposal for something alternative and not necessarily a rejection of a certain tactic. It would be cool to see a campaign of autonomous action that, on its own, leads to the defeat of a pipeline project of this scale. But I think the frequency and intensity of action required to accomplish this on its own would be very difficult to sustain. Without a large enough network of people willing and capable of maintaining that intensity and pressure for a long period of time, the companies seem to be able to regroup, recover, or rebuild faster than groups can deliver these diffuse blows. And don't get me wrong here, this is not a criticism of affinity group-based action. It's an acknowledgement that it can't just be one tactic and that we need it all. We need actions to get stronger, more clever, and frequent. We need blockades, camps, and reoccupations, and we definitely need community participation. Most importantly, though, we need to act with intention and with an analysis of impact so as to ensure our efforts and risk are worth it. All these different approaches are important in developing a culture of resistance.
So, building on Kay's response, I think absolutely. I'm going to speak more generally to this idea of autonomous anarchist struggle and this discussion that I see happening in the anarchist space more broadly, rather than just in the call to action that you're referencing. This question of an autonomous struggle, it's a social, not a military question. It's not a frontal clash between two armies, the police and industry on one side, and clearly defined revolutionaries on the other. Like, no matter how determined, how trained a small set of affinity groups think they are, they alone can't stop a massive project. If you're struggling as isolated affinity groups, then the drawback is isolation, which is why this needs to be a social attempt. I think what a small set of affinity groups can offer is examples, pushing struggles in certain directions, and being in dialogue with others, expanding the imagination. And that's what that proposal has to offer. That's why organizing into affinity groups cannot become a military question. Developing simply a capacity to create enough damage to stop a project, but instead an attempt for a constellation of groups that are self-organized, struggling, and experimenting in a way that hopefully touches others. And that might not be immediate either. It may take years before certain anarchist methods are taken up by others. But I think there's a value in certain methods being taken up by anarchists that have a capacity to go beyond leaders, representatives, and mediation. And we need to be in dialogue with others about that. That can look like a lot of different things. It's not a question of just intense action, but a way of approaching life that centers ourselves, our desires, and following our hearts. Not waiting for others to tell us what to do, not looking to others to solve our problems, but of direct action beginning from ourselves. You asked, are there any other anarchist proposals circulating about what to do? I don't think there's explicit proposals publicly available. Similarly, that call to action is just a publicly available snapshot of part of a larger discussion. So, while nothing is publicly or explicitly available, other anarchists have been actively participating in Native-led blockades. But through their action, there's a proposal of participating in Indigenous-led initiatives. And I'm sure that will be an ongoing practice as well. To be clear, I think that this also opens up lots of valuable space to meet one another, and many of the relationships developed out of the CGL struggle, I think, are invaluable. Any kind of proposal of struggle needs to think about how to meet each other and how to have a social element. That's the magic of a blockade, is the experience of sharing a life together with people. And what that looks like is more tricky in a more autonomous, affinity-based struggle. Those sites of encounter need to be experimented with. To be clear, they also aren't dichotomous. Comrades engaging in a more autonomous, affinity-based struggle may also participate in blockades.
You might have different takes on this question, but I'm curious if resisting the PRGT is about winning for you, you know, stopping the pipeline from being built. Is it about something else or both?
We're fighting to win, and that can take many forms. Stopping PRGT would be a win. Stopping CGL would be a win. The unbreakable bonds and relationships that are created through struggle are wins. Gaining experience, training, and knowledge to better take on the next battle is a win. But no matter how successful we are at fighting industrial resource extraction, as long as Canada exists or has authority over these lands, there will always be another threat on the horizon. Canada is the main problem that needs to be dealt with. The Canadian and provincial governments are the ones who authorize, facilitate, and secure the construction of these projects. If we're always bogged down responding to industrial projects, it is very difficult to advance the struggle in different ways. A lot of us still haven't recovered or caught up on the parts of our lives that were put on hold to fight CGL. And here we are, a couple of years later, facing the exact same thing again. CGL faced one of the largest, fiercest, mass-supportive, and diverse struggles in recent history, costing them years of delays and millions over budget. Yet, a couple of years later, in the same region, there is another pipeline project. You'd think they'd go somewhere else after seeing that, but they don't care because they have the backing and security assurance of the Canadian state to guarantee that they will be able to carry out their project. To me, the future looks like an exponential increase in resource extraction projects to assure Canada's national security and national sovereignty in the face of U.S. uncertainty. Successfully stopping a mega project is rare, but stopping project after project after project is not only unlikely, it's not sustainable for those involved. Like I said above, there are many great things that come out of intense struggle, but obviously there are negatives too. It can break communities, relationships, and families. loved ones get locked up, or lose their passion for the struggle. So to me, fighting to win looks like getting prepared, trained, and organized. It looks like networking, collaborating, and coordinating with other communities facing similar threats. It's taking solidarity to the next level and pushing the limits of clandestine action into new terrain. It's taking a moment to think things through a few steps so we aren't always just responding to threats. Winning looks like losing over and over again, but carrying forward our lessons and experiences so we can act quicker, stronger, and with more precision, avalanching toward a coordinated liberation.
Yeah, like, of course we want to stop these projects, but we need to see them as just the tip of a spear. And I think part of this question of winning and losing are these deeply personal questions of dignity and our lives, and what decisions do we make that we're proud of and can look back on. By fighting, we're winning in a certain sense. Any struggle not fought is lost. In fighting, we can assert our dignity, we can have moments that touch our hearts and touch the hearts of others. Not to be overly optimistic either, because there's also a lot of tragedy and hardship involved in struggling. But I think we should celebrate fighting as well. Not in a way where everyone gets a trophy kind of thing, but that in a world of resignation and what sometimes feels like this crushing weight of social peace and the omnipresence of the state and just catastrophe after catastrophe, holding our heads high and refusing that is something powerful.